Abe here, and I wanted to let you know that if you're able, you can upgrade your small beans skill over at patreon.com/smallbeans. Here's why you should do that. If you pledge 5 measly beans a month, you get access to about half our podcasts that you don't get if you're just listening to the free feed. Shows include Star Trek The Next Futurama, Spiel Boys, Like Razor Blade Pie, and bonus episodes of I'll Show You Mine If You Show Me Yours. Not to mention bonus content including info and updates on the movie we're making, Papa Bear. Hey, where's all the reasons to not subscribe to Patreon? I can't find them. Anyway, back to the show.
Abe, I was deeply disappointed to learn this isn't a Michael Bay film. I really thought this one was Michael Bay. It really did.
It's a part of my theory, in fact.
We were talking about it last week, and I was like, wait, that's a fucking Michael Bay film. And you were like, nah, bro.
Nah, dude.
And I couldn't believe
it's
that
Con
shit.
Con Air has nothing to do with Michael Bay, other than, I guess, Jerry Bruckheimer produced.
Yeah, he does seem like part of the original... an ingredient to the Michael Bay formula, right?
Oh, he's the Rock, baby.
Yeah. You love that Joker bit so much. It's your favorite.
I love saying baby.
You do.
Like a fool.
You do.
I love being a fool.
Sure. That's why we're doing this job instead of like being lawyers or whatever.
Oh, God.
Can I mention to you? Yeah, man. Get depressed about what could have been.
Oh, God.
Can I mention to you how disappointed I was when I watched this that I never thought of being Cameron Poe on Escape from the Multicurse?
Like, I mean, he's...
I wanted to do that
all-time
so bad.
Banger, dude. Cameron Poe is Nicolas Cage's character in Con Air.
My God.
And what is he doing?
What is his deal? Like, oh, my God. We would have had so much fun. A good hour of that.
Good, he's man.
Excellent. Yes, truly
just
excellent.
Memorable as fuck. I love it so much.
Like, the performance is a hairstyle. We agree with that, right? Like, that
yeah,
is the performance.
Basically.
It's a hairstyle.
It's a wind glistening through his sweaty hair.
His slicked back untied hair.
As he soaks in the freedom. You know, I don't know why we don't just cut to the chase and just call this film America.
I don't know either.
It's got it all. X-Ranger, newborn babies to fight for, incompetent cops discussing jurisdiction. Now you're out of line. And just going at high speeds and Nicolas Cage narrating.
That's all anyone wants.
Talking about his little child that he's never met. Fucking love it.
He got 10 years for the crime that begins this film, by the way, which seems insane.
Nothing makes sense once you start picking it apart. Like, what is he doing on this, like, high...
Why is he on this plane at all?
Like, he's just a manslaughter charge. Right. Like, why... Like, there's other planes. Like,
put him in a car and take him there. What are we doing?
You don't need to put him with the Hannibal Lecter.
Why do we need...
You know, like...
Why do we need... He's getting discharged. He's on his way to being discharged. Why is he on any plane? Just put him outside. That's it.
Just put him outside. Let him figure it out. Yeah, that's how it works as far as I understand.
Give him his cigarette lighter. They're all obligated to have an old cigarette lighter. Just give it to him and let him walk around.
Just kick rocks,
yeah,
Nick Cage.
Kick rocks, bro. They didn't do that, though, and thank God
they
didn't
do that. They needed to put him on the plane.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
So I was watching this movie, as one does, alone.
For funsies, right?
Let's be honest. A Tuesday night.
Yeah.
You know? And I had the thought, hey... You know, be a good episode of Director Piece Theater, which is what the show is.
Right.
I'm Abe Epperson. That's Adam Ganser.
Mm.
This is where we talk about directors and the tactics they employ to make movies that we love or didn't expect to be like good or whatnot. You know, like, oh, wow, there's craft here. And I was like, man, we should look at the construction of 1997's Con Air. And as you alluded to, that's a sentence that made it clear to me why my mom preferred that I do become a lawyer or something. Because like that's where my brain goes. Legitimately, that gives me joy. The construction of Con Air gives me joy.
Yeah.
And I have to think about the existential merit of that.
Yes. And it makes your mother grieve. You're just grieving your mother.
And it makes a lot of sadness in my family around what I could have been.
Christmas.
Because I could have been a ranger. I could have been Nicolas Cage in this movie. And she would probably be like, now that's my
son. Now that's a son. That's a name that we can all be proud of. Stand
no,
behind.
I love you, Mom. Yeah. You don't listen to any of my podcasts because you don't care. Because I understand.
Because you're not a ranger.
Why would you do that? But, you know, much love to you.
If you were a ranger, do you think she'd listen to your podcast?
I don't think so. Mm. If I talked about ranger shit,
if
I don't think
she's
just got a podcast in her.
Okay, fair enough. I like to think that she would. If you were a ranger, she'd tune into your podcast. That makes me happy.
Yep.
To think
I gotta get it. I gotta get to my theory.
Sorry.
One love, Mom. One love.
One love.
All right. So Nicolas Cage is a ranger, as we mentioned.
Yeah.
We start this film with a salute to Rangers. He comes home from the war. I don't know.
Right.
And he's got a pregnant wife. Yeah.
I assume
he's like Black Ops. They mentioned at one point he's Black Ops.
He went to Iraq? Is that what we assume?
Don't pin me down, baby.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Point is, he's got a pregnant wife.
Yeah.
And he's like, baby, I love you. And she's like, I love you, baby. And a drunk, they're at a bar and a drunk shits on the military, which is always... What a Bruckheimer thing is just instant.
Yeah, you
instant
piece of
asshole
shit.
Character.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's just, I just want to make love, baby. I don't want to fight. And outside after that night, the group of local drunks that were making fun of him for being in the military and like a lethal weapon
and for
like
having a
body,
wife.
Yeah, and having a wife and just dancing. They beat on him. And they pull a knife, and so he's like, "Ah, gotta get serious." And he punches the main drunk so good at him that he dies.
I know. They slowed it down and everything.
And this is something that is like one of those cultural urban myths. I'm sure someone will be like, "Well, actually, which you know, cool. Like this has happened probably manslaughter charges just on like." I'm not talking about like I push someone and they like fall on a rock and hit their head and they're dead.
But if you punch him in the throat or something.
I punch him in the throat and that guy's just an instant kill.
Yeah.
And we're supposed to be like, wow, he's a really good ranger. But obviously it's the double-edged sword of I'm too strong.
See, I would argue that was actually kind of confusing because I thought for a second, did he grab that guy's knife and stab him in the jaw? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think they didn't show the knife as much. They needed the knife to show threat of violence,
correct.
Like real violence.
Correct.
But yeah, they didn't want Nicolas Cage to have the knife because he's got to be the underdog. You know?
Well,
we're like 4 minutes into the movie.
It's like it felt like 4 seconds into the movie. Like you're just trying to get your bearings, and he's getting trashed outside in the pouring rain. You know?
Yeah.
And you're like,
he basically
what?
Gets a manslaughter charge as the setup because the judge is like, you're too fucking rad. We have to put you in prison.
Mr. Cage, you've pled guilty, which was supposed to get you 2 years, but you're so awesome at killing. I gotta punish you more.
You're that urban myth that, like, you know, these guns aren't legal kind of idea that that joke that everyone makes, or whatever the fuck the joke they all make about their guns.
Your hands are registered lethal weapons.
That's it. And you know, fuck it. Like that's a good start. That's enough. We know what we need to know about him. Let's get on a fucking plane.
Sure.
You know,
this is before Mad Max Fury Road, but you could sense the man on the guitar cart being
he's standing on deck.
He's chugging right now already. Yes.
Yeah, dude. In any case, like it's alarming how many times when you really look at the pieces, this is just Die Hard. At one point, he even draws on a Dave Chappelle's shirt, dead Dave Chappelle's shirt, and throws him off the plane to send a note to John Cusack. Killer cast, by the way.
Oh my God, incredible cast.
Like, who we got?
Bing Rhames?
Nick Cage, John Cusack, John Malkovich,
Cole
Steve Buscemi.
Meany.
Cole Meany. Fuck me, dude. Just a bunch of
Chappelle.
Just a bunch of dudes. Danny Trejo.
Trejo. Just one of the dudes.
Just one of the dudes, and they're all monsters, which is great.
You said Buscemi,
right?
That must
have been fun. Yeah, Buscemi is in there as the the worst of them all, the Hannibal Lecter character, I guess. So yeah, he's going to die hard on this plane. But this movie actually has something that I think is slightly anthemic to this era of the action films. I'm specifically focusing on like kind of the mid to late 90s and even into the early 2000s, where it's kind of like what we would call like the Michael Bay takeover.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
the bakeover.
And it's not like a takeover where he's like, this is how it's made now. It's just people mimicking people, mimicking people, and seeing something that they're like, that's a really effective way to do that. I'm going to do that in my film. That's all anything ever is anyway. So yeah, they're doing some stuff in this movie that is like directly out of the book of other action movies of this era. And so I noticed this first when we were looking around the plane setup and how it's like, it's straight up just cells and shielding around the hull.
Yeah.
Makes it all feel sterile. Basically, it's just prison-like, right? They made a prison on a plane, which is not how I assume they do this kind of thing in real life.
I don't know.
But it doesn't matter.
But we must remember that the movie The Fugitive was a huge hit.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah, true.
That scene in The Fugitive is basically this movie.
Right.
Right? Like,
but that's like a normal bus with a grate
right.
at the front.
That's a,
you know?
I'm going to use this word very gently, grounded movie.
That's a grounded movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is like, we have like crazy, like lockdown mechanisms
right.
and multiple areas that are just, you know, prisons, I guess.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I wanted to kind of pick apart what that is doing and how that's like other films too.
I'm excited.
And there's also other stuff that we could talk at length about, but I'll just mention, you know, it's not just the normal fanfare, like the explosive finale and how they do that, or like, you know, the character roles and some of the light racism and weird, you know, like in this movie, a little bit of transphobia of multiple
right.
characters. It's the 90s, baby.
Yeah. yeah.
So you're probably guessing at this point, yep, it's another visual strategy episode. And this time it's Simon West, the director of Con Air. So let's unpack how this kind of works. So I mentioned the plane. I want to talk about geography. You know me. I love my geography.
I do.
I love it when it's clear. And you know what makes a clear geography?
Wide shots.
Wide shots.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know what Con Air doesn't have in its act one, really? Wide shots.
Yeah.
Something I noticed right after the assemble the crew section. You know, where they're like, ah, oh, this one's called Cyrus the Virus. He's a real piece of shit. You know, there's no wide shots. It's all close-ups of faces and close-ups of, you know, John Cusack kind of announcing it. And we see a little bit outside, you know, like the plane, you know, people mm-hmm. in line and stuff, mm-hmm. but a lot less wide than you expect it to be. You don't see the full plane. You don't even see, you see barely a part of the plane. So we have that section, which is not really doing a lot of favors because it's doing character introduction. It's
right.
not doing geography. Also, it's not a space that they're going to exist. It's a liminal space before they get into the plane itself. But once they arrive at the plane, we get this short section where the inmates meet as they're placed in their kind of spots, respective spots. So we start to see the relative geography that's going to carry us through at least not like halfway through the movie, but like 30% of the movie. Where everyone's kind of seated where they're supposed to be and locked down.
I don't think we ever know where people are seated. I don't feel like we ever know that.
We don't, because they don't really show wides of the plane. And I found that to be interesting.
Yeah.
Because we do see some relative geography of inmates and the guards that you can imply from eye lines. Like they're
right.
distant, they're over there, but like, again, no wide that shows everyone in there. It's just bits and pieces of the guards placing like these high-profile murderers in essentially cages that are closed off. And it's all done fairly close from a camera perspective. And that's because we're worrying about the faces. We're setting the stage in terms of these are our characters. We're not really caring about the geography being clear. And I think that that's interesting. I love clear geography in movies. It makes my brain feel good. I think that it's an underrated strategy to adhere to the rules that allow people to be like, I know where everything is, especially because you can fuck with that and surprise people. But that's neither here nor there. I just think it's smart. Now, this movie's erring on the side of the characters and their faces, kind of locking in the minds of the audience members, like who's who and where they're sitting. But since it's going to all get mixed up soon anyway, like, I actually think it's a smart choice by the movie. We don't need to show it, and we need to favor something else because we're just, much like Aliens or much like a lot of films like Avatar or whatnot, like, films that, like, have, like, all right, here's the crew that you're going to be with the whole time, Armageddon. These movies, you want to get as much face time with, you know, the Ving Rhames, with the, you know, John Malkovich's as possible.
With the Syrah.
It's not just, like, one protagonist that we have to follow. It's, like, you want to follow the group.
Well,
and you don't want a single amount.
This movie has a huge problem that it has to overcome, which is it has so much exposition up top.
Yeah.
Like, it has 25, 30 minutes of setup to do that, like, you know, and it still needs to be fun in an action movie right up top so that it can pull a fugitive. And, like, it's interesting you're pointing out that they don't do wides, because, like, the only films that I can compare to it in terms of exposition is probably a Nolan film. Like, Nolan has this same problem a lot.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah. I think that they're not derivative, but, like, there is a passage of...
Yeah, he's,
you know,
an iteration on this. Because he's...
Exactly. He learned from this.
He's decided, I'm going to shoot it in mostly wides and just, like, fuck you, you don't care about this character. This character, you don't need to care about him. They're just in the scene.
Yeah, he's on screen and he's off screen and talking, and you don't need to care.
Yeah,
it's
you don't
just
need to know
the words he's saying.
Right.
Yeah.
If he...
Especially on something like Tenet, which I think people actually were like, that's going too far.
Right. Right. If Nolan...
Because you can...
Yeah. If Nolan was making Con Air, you would never care about... You would never care about Dave Chappelle's character, or, like,
not really,
the Native American
guy
he burns alive, or you just wouldn't, you know?
Right. But you do in, like, these types
of
films
in
this era.
It works in this movie.
Because you mentioned, like, the fat act one, a lot of exposition. Same thing happens in The Rock, you know? Like, Michael Bay is victim of this as well.
Absolutely.
And I don't know if it's a victim. It's a choice. He's like, this is how... I want to get the pace going. Exposition is an easy way to, like, evoke pace, because you can just have wall-to-wall explanation of shit over shots, montage over, you know, whatever you want to show. So that's one of the reasons I think they do this, but I'll get to that more later about the pacing. Now, the other thing about... So if wide shots aren't there, what is there?
Yeah.
And I kind of alluded to it. You get tons of singles coverage in telephoto. You really notice it when they're, like, on the airfield coming up to the plane in the early stages of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But even in the small space of the plane, and this is an important distinction about, like, outside versus inside, it's harder to do what I'm saying, you know, about to say, the telephoto kind of close-ups, it's harder to do in a smaller space.
Absolutely.
And control it, because your lens is so long that it's like, sometimes you're like, well, my background is oppressive now, or it doesn't have as much detail as I'd want, so it's just like a gray blob and it doesn't look good. So in the small, but this is how these films were shot, like, ever since, like, Bad Boys, ever since all these types of movies started coming out, the telephoto single is, like, almost a decree.
Yeah.
That's just how we show action movies in this era. It's not how we'd show Die Hard. Like, Die Hard has zero of this.
No, he's on mediums.
But it's been the Michael Bay era, and it continues to be. Watch all the Transformers, watch all the Michael Bay, like, later films, and you see that shit. And Simon West is essentially doing that, which I'll go into why he's doing that a little bit later as well.
Do you think that, so, like, it's weird because, and I don't want to get too far into your theory and disrupt what you're up to, but, like, you kind of have to be able to move set pieces around to shoot things this way.
Kind of.
Right?
And they probably had a method for that, because it's clearly a set and they could probably pull walls out.
They have to. There's no way to, so, like, as you're implying, being on a telephoto lens means I got to be really far away from what I'm shooting, right? And that means, and so like, if you're trying to find the most economical way to shoot a plane set, you know, unless you can move those walls out, telephoto is the opposite of what you would do. Right? Like, wide angle is what you do. I did a scene on a plane set and I learned a lot about how not to shoot it.
How not to shoot it. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And that's interesting.
There's a lot of not flattering angles in it. Now, the reason that they're doing this is to make the composition controlled and simplistic. I always argue that when we got to the auteur filmmaking era, you know, at least after the 80s, you know, and the arrival, even the 70s, the arrival of people like Ridley Scott and Tony Scott, where they were coming from commercial work. Commercial work was almost in the same way that these movies do, preaching the telephoto lens as gospel. And it's because you can make the background composition easily. Like a wide angle lens, if you there's something in the back of frame you don't like, it's sometimes you have to move a mountain to make that work if you still want that composition. Whereas on a telephoto lens, you just pivot over 2 inches. And because of the crazy angle of incidence that's happening with this lens, you can make it work. It's controlled, it's simplistic. You can decide what your background is, if you want it to be a motley series of colors, if you want it to be blurred to all, you know, hell, you can make it look beautiful. And it is a beautiful lens. You get blurring of the background and the foreground. That's one of the effects of a telephoto lens. So the shots look crisp. And it's a favor of, like I was saying, like Michael Mann, Michael Bay, Ridley, Tony Scott, basically a lot of directors that were crushing action movies in this era, and setting the stage for this is how action movies look. And you get mimicry all over the place, including, I would argue, in 97, one of the early adopters of this. And I would actually argue that Simon West, this is his debut.
Oh, is it?
Which is crazy.
That's it. How did he get this film first?
I don't know. But if I had to suggest, and this is something that, you know, Marvel movies haven't really said, but I've said, in my opinion, like, I think this is what's occurring, you know, based off conversations and interviews, you know, like a lot of, you know, the whole Edgar Wright Ant-Man thing, you know, Ryan Coogler's, you know, dissatisfaction with how Black Panther was made. You got a studio that is like, look, I know what I want. I want Michael Bay. I can't get Michael Bay. Go do Michael Bay, Simon West. So you get a young director who will basically be bossed around. And Jerry Bruckheimer was big enough at this point that he could basically, he was the studio.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
Marvel in this
absolutely.
Case. So
after Top Gun?
He could just, yeah. So he could just do that. He was like, yeah, I worked with Tony Scott. Like, I loved how that looked. Can we do that, more of that, please? And you get that vibe. He's churning them out, baby.
I don't know if this disrupts everything you're going to do, Abe, but I think it's important to acknowledge that Simon West is also known for directing Never Gonna Give You Up by Rick Astley, the music video.
Oh, yeah, baby. Like, it's
the internet's favorite thing.
In fact, he had to choke out Michael Bay in order to get the job. Also important on his, like, so right after Con Air, he did The General's Daughter.
Yeah, amazing.
Which is, we love The General's Daughter in this house.
Oh, yeah.
Also, Lara Croft, Tomb Raider, the 2001 version.
Yeah.
And Expendables since then, 2. He's created, you know, some garbage, like The Mechanic and Expendables 2. And he's got a great career, man.
He's worked.
I would love to have this career.
Yeah, he's worked.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a bad life.
It's not a bad life. Simon West.
He's done a bunch of other stuff that you haven't heard of. You know, like, but those are the ones you have heard of.
Right. So let's move on to like the breakout in the film. Like when, you know, Dave Chappelle does his little hijinks and burns a man and, you know, pulls the lever and gets John Malkovich and company out of their cages. Even this is still singles of people. They're just single cut to single cut to single. There's no wides. There's just telephoto angles of faces doing the things that I was just saying. And when there is kind of a wider shot, it's like at their feet. And by, I don't mean wide shot in terms of field of view. I mean wide angle, actually, right. I should say. Sometimes they choose a wider angle and not a telephoto angle. But in those cases, they put the camera like on the ground looking up, so like from their feet, so you're not getting depth you're taking the width and the depth away from the wide angle lens, which is one of the reasons you use a wide angle lens. Also, they do stuff like obstructing a lot of the wide angles. It's not a weird choice. I mean, it kind of fits, but it's just like, it's clear they're doing everything they can to not stitch together this location.
Yeah.
And that's maybe out of necessity. We're not sure.
Well, can we briefly talk about what would necessitate that?
Right.
Like, so one idea that occurred to me as I was reading your theory is maybe they didn't have everybody all these days.
Yeah, like maybe one of the reasons, or that would be one of the benefits of this shooting strategy, is you wouldn't need them.
Right. So, like, just to be clear for people who are not filmmakers, so, like, you know, every production you have to plan what days everyone's available, right? And, like, one of the assumptions that's 100% not true is that, you know, you get all the actors together and they all shoot together for those 30 days or whatever it is. But the truth is, when you get a cast of this caliber, even back then, I think, you're going to deal with somebody, you know, like, hey, I can't be there that week, but you need to be filming that week, which means you got to compose shots to not see them so you don't miss them.
Right.
This shooting style would accommodate that. I kind of wonder if that's part of what's happening here. I also wanted to bring up as a counterpoint, because I think that we've both watched this film recently and it's interesting. This is the same year that Event Horizon was made, right? Okay. And Event Horizon, like, went to great pains to show you the set.
The set. And even if you're close in, wide angle, that shit.
Right. But, like, the problem with it is then you start picking the set apart. And one of the smart things about this movie is you never really pick the plane apart, right?
No. Nope.
You don't think about it, really.
Yeah.
So it's kind of effective.
And sometimes that's the allure of these telephoto lenses that feel like when the pace is right and you're moving at a certain speed, you don't really fucking ask questions.
Yeah.
And some of those questions are like, wait, where is everybody?
Yeah, where are people?
And it doesn't piss you off. Whereas in another instance where you're like, that's important and the pace isn't as quick and I'm not spending time thinking about it, you could be totally angry as an audience member about it. And then in another instance, you find it forgivable. You don't even think about it. That's how much power a director really has by making these decisions. Another decision I noticed is that the shots are flat. This is kind of an effect of not shooting with the wide angle lens. Wide angle lenses are very good at showing depth,
right?
Because something that we call like kind of depth cues are things like diagonal lines, deep backgrounds, perspective shots, so we get the feeling of like it goes off to infinity. Wide angles give you more opportunity for layering in the frame. You can have multiple mid positions and foreground and background. Not as true in the case of a telephoto lens, and in fact, it's quite the opposite. And then John Malkovich talks. You know, it kind of the bow breaks and the inmates have control. And John Malkovich takes his center position and is like, I got the plane.
Underlit, too, in a funny way.
And yeah, and that's when we finally get a wide of the whole ship. And this is the only argument for why, like, they clearly made the whole ship and they had it.
Oh, yeah.
Because you have that. And in fact, there's a great shot of when he kind of chirps up and he's like, everyone pay attention. There's a shot down the tube of the plane that is like the deepest shot in the whole thing. It's got multiple layers of depth as inmates kind of perk up like prairie dogs in different, you know, distances on the Z-axis from the camera. So not all shots fall in this kind of flat, deep dichotomy. And I suspect that these closer wides and telephoto lenses, telephoto singles that were seen earlier, come from knowing also that it's our central location. And he didn't want to blow his wad in the first 20 minutes and show all the geography. So he waited for the act one break. And so the next 40 minutes aren't boring. And Adam talked about this on another director piece theater with John Hughes and Breakfast Club. Varying your perspectives around beats of the film give the visual cue to the audience that we're like kind of in a new stage. They're definitely doing this in Con Air. At least subconsciously, it will feel different, even if you're like, oh, now we're from this side, or now we're using these angles. You'll notice it, because it's just how we perceive the canvas. Now, as you mentioned, this may be done out of necessity, but like most filmmaking that's done well, your limitations kind of guide your decisions and strengthen the project. That's just, if you're the smallest filmmaker with the lowest budget, or you're Michael Bay, that is true.
Yeah, well, it has to be true if you want to continue to work.
Right. And a final thought on the wide shots, telephoto shot aspect of this movie, is the widest shots in this movie are outside. The tarmacs and the landing sequence. And that's kind of not surprising when, like, the inmates leave the plane, we start to see a little bit more wides as well. And I think there's some subconscious, like, wide is freedom that may obvious to some. Also, the love sequences, which are outside, but, like, the love sequences where he's, like, talking to his daughter and his wife, which happens twice. Love is, like, a long shot. It's always a long shot. And that is... throws into the face, since it both happens outside, throws in the face of the idea that just because you're outside, that means it's a wide angle. It's very intentional when he's deploying these lenses and when he's not.
Do you think he's do you think that the director's thinking analytically about, like, making that connection, or is it about, do you think that the director thinks that the more compressed the space, the more intimate I feel with the character?
My opinion is that I think most directors fire from the hip.
Yeah.
And it's an instinctual learning that comes from just watching and developing a grammar of film by just consuming all of the greats, all of the shitty movies that you watch in your life. You kind of develop, oh, I like that, I like that, I like that. If I were to make a film, I'd I'm going to do it this way. I do think that smarter filmmakers and filmmakers who know what they're doing and why they're doing it, which is most filmmakers, honestly, like, maybe not TV, where they're, like, following a prescribed paint by numbers kind of rota. Like, this is more like when you have not just an auteur, but, like, someone who's kind of got a studio that has a light hand, or they have, they're, you know, they're known for their, you know, like someone like Jordan Peele or something like that, you know, to give, you know, a relevant example of, like, they give them freedom, right? I think that the people who know what they're doing often will think about it technically. Maybe they'll find it after the fact, but they'll be like, oh yeah, that is what I want. And I want it these, like, might as well keep doing
it if
it makes sense for the film.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, sometimes they break their own formats because they know it's not, like, the end all be all that people glean this kind of stuff, like how the shots remark on the thematic resonance. I don't think that you get points for that. Maybe in my book, in my nerdy book, but I don't think that audience members are like, oh, that's crazy how the telephoto lenses are really being deployed in the act two. You know, like, that shit doesn't really matter.
Right.
But it does. But if you understand what a telephoto lens does to the canvas, does to the image itself, and you're using it effectively to construct a visual strategy that effectively aligns with your theme or your story, you know, then I think that you're doing the narrative justice, and it's a better work for that purpose. So absolutely, I think that the best people think about it technically.
I love that answer. I thought that was really well elocuted.
Thank you. Well done. Let's talk about cops and
robbers. That's all I wanted to do. let's get to the cops.
So sometimes we talk about in this movie, you often have with your antagonist, protagonist, or different groups of people, you have two basic spaces, right? Or three basic spaces. But in this movie, it's two basic spaces that exist in this movie. Like most movies about crime or the criminal justice system, there's the criminal side and there's the cop side. I do want to mention that while most of the movie is preoccupied with maintaining speed and momentum, and I'll talk about that, how, like, the Michael Bay influence and other filmmakers' influence in the speedy kind of pacing of scenes, you will notice a lot of static shots in the Cusack Colmeany scenes.
Yeah.
And I think that this is very intentional, because on the reverse side, you get crazy amounts of momentum, small dolly moves, drifts to the face, like whip pans and stuff like that. And the Cusack Colmeany stuff is just, like, absolutely mundane. And I think this is supposed to be kind of their home base, and the inmates are kind of always on the move. That's kind of what they're setting up there. But there isn't much of a difference in what he's doing between these two spaces. Like, you could go even further, and typically films do, where they say, like, this world looks like this, this world is looks like this, and I'm separating these worlds so that you really feel it. When I cut, I know, oh, I'm with the cops now. But Wes doesn't do that as much, other than the thing I just mentioned. He actually does the opposite. He, in terms of like color affinity and color differences, the backgrounds are gray and blue, mm-hmm. In the Cusack Colmeny stuff. And that's true of like the whole movie, also on the plane. So you don't really get like a color differentiation of worlds or like a production design differentiation of worlds. A lot of movies do that, but Con Air is trying to make the whole thing feel cohesive, because I think it knows that it moves at a clip, you know, and it's like, I don't have time, just like the decision for, I don't have time to show you the geography of every scene. I'm not really going to throw a lot of color stuff at you or lighting changes at you, because I want you to just be on for the ride. I don't want you to have to think about the scene or like, where are we are.
I think that's right. I think
you just kind of roll with it.
It would be a problem for the movie if I had to emotionally divest myself or get interested in, exactly. Like, well, what are the cops up to? You know, like, right. How do they feel
and
that
that's
stuff? Like,
kind of the job of the director. You don't want that, like, something that one of my professors mentioned is, he said, like, the difference between theater and film is not the acting, it's not the rehearsal. A lot of people talk about that, and that's true. But what a director and what they really do when it comes to the image and how that influences literally everything when you're making a movie, is that you're guiding the eye. When I'm in the audience, I can look at any fucking thing while I'm watching it play. Right. I can look at that person's shoe. I can look at that person's face. I can look at like an extra in the corner. You have no power over me. I am the determiner of what I see. That's not true in movies. Movies are like, nope. I mean, it is to a little extent. Like, you can be a little piece of shit and be like, haha, you'll never catch me. I'll look at the backgrounds all the time. But you more or less are guided. And I think this speaks to Simon West kind of, and Michael Bay and all these other filmmakers, that they're just like, if I don't give them time to be distracted, I have them. And I think that there's power in that. And so he's matching the drabness of the plane with its grates and its metal plating with these gray and blue backgrounds where, frankly, they shouldn't exist. One scene in particular, Cusack talks to Nick Cage's wife and kid in his office. And like, the color affinity is wild. It's blue folders, right. Blue walls, yeah. Blue overalls on the little girl. Even the wife's eyes, I'm almost like, I'm 50% confident that they hired this woman because she has crazy blue eyes just for these scenes. It just reminds me of how far you can go with this stuff before it becomes loud enough to really notice. I think that most viewers would watch this and it would totally pass them by. But if you're looking at the affinity of, like, the color affinity of these shots, you're like, holy shit, this whole thing is blue and it's all production design. And that makes me think of kind of how, like, Director P started with The Wedding mm-hmm. Singer. You kind of have to go really far to get noticed, because people will take a lot for granted. And that's cool. That's a cool thing about movies. It means that we have more leeway as directors and storytellers to do exactly what we want.
I actually think you notice emphasizing. You notice more when a director isn't doing that.
Yes, like, because then you're like, what am I supposed to
right focus on? Like, you assume the director is gonna reduce the amount of stimuli, like, in a film, especially if the film has any action or sci-fi elements or something. Like, that's just sort of the template. Or like, if the movie takes place in Wall Street, for instance, right? Like, every movie in Wall Street is the same color palette, basically.
Yeah.
You know,
it's like, it's beige and gray.
Beige, gray, blue, you know what I mean? Like, this is sort of the action movie color template. This is kind of an early film for that, actually.
But the cool hues and the blues are like definitely a thing that occurred in the late 90s for sure.
And it just stuck around.
Once we got into the 2000s and after the digital intermediate, which is, if you're not aware of that, it kind of started with like, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? If you've seen that Coen Brothers movie, it has like a caked in look that makes it feel old timey. That's a lot of that is like the heavy processing in digital post, where you essentially can put a tint on the whole movie and still make it look really good, where it's not just like a filter that looks crappy on things, like a sepia filter or something like that. And a lot of people mimic that. That's like, you could draw like a direct parallel to like how Harry Potter movies started to look dark and creepy and more like David Fincher films. In fact, we talked about that in One Director Piece Theater. That's because it was just in the early 2000s, people couldn't get enough of that shit, you know? And it's also why we get things like The Spirit or Sin City, where you have the complete opposite, where it's just like creating a totally other world. All right.
Sorry for the distraction.
Let's talk about,
I apologize.
Let's pivot away from image and talk about time.
Yeah.
Specifically, I want to kind of introduce like what I've been hinting at with Michael Bay and that era, like as he started with like The Rock and, you know, pacing and how pacing was being developed during this time, like 1995 to 19, you know, or to 2000. Like the speed is another one that comes to mind. So when people do a thing over and over, typically, and I'd say this is true about most aspects of life, they typically call it like a tactic or a style, like that's that person's style. But when a whole group of people do it, it now becomes something that we call like a genre or a form, right? One could argue that there's like a style of Wes Anderson, and then there's twee films, right?
That's true.
And I think we probably not get a lot of disagreement on that. I know it's not one-to-one for every case, but, you know, one person started it and someone else kind of copied it or, you know, developed it even further. Sometimes it's also convergent evolution. It's just we're at the right time where we're going to, like, I think that if you look internationally in the early 2000s, you got a lot of displacement of time films and nonlinear storytelling coming from Mexico, coming from Britain, coming from America. Yeah, they influenced each other, but I think it was just about time that movies were like, let's really fuck with how and which we tell the movie and not just do a literal, like, linear thing. But that's not important. In any case, there comes a time when it's not yet a cliche, something that someone does in a movie, but people are mimicking it because it just feels like the right thing to do. And Exhibit A, in this case, is what I would say is Michael Bay and his kind of, you know, ability to kind of just like knock people's socks off with some of his shots. And he definitely popularized like the high speed pacing of a lot of his narratives in the late 90s and early 2000s. A lot of scenes jump around from one conversation to another. I hinted at the fact that you get one group of characters and then another, and we don't really shoot what we'd call a basic sequence where you get a wide shot and singles of the subjects, because that would be too much investment for this short scene where it's like three lines or whatever. So we started to see films and TV crop up that would cut out the wide or just have fewer lines per scene. And then we cut to another one, and we cut to another one. And ultimately, I feel like this is where you get the intense momentum of these movies. And that's probably starting in the 70s, but like ultimately they refined it to like a specific pacing in the 90s. There's this kind of joke that Michael Bay is always at an 11,
oh, yes.
Right? One of our story professors at school would have a lecture where he kind of quotes the famous Kurt Vonnegut story lecture, which you can find on YouTube, and it's great, and any storyteller or person interested in the forms of storytelling should definitely check that out, where he explains drama of stories with things like bell curves and sine waves, where he says, like, all right, so if the x-axis is time, and, you know, the y-axis is drama or excitement of the audience member or whatever you really want to in that vein. What are the forms that we have appropriated for storytelling through the history of time? And it's all about the dynamics of feeling momentum and how traditionally pacing would be proportional to those aspects of the story, like an all is lost moment or, you know, the highest of the highs. Obviously, you'd get a very specific difference between those two. So the professor would make this joke where he would just draw a line at the top of the graph at the very height of the y-axis and say, what story is this? And then he would make the joke, it's a Michael Bay film. And yeah, laugh, good bit. But this high-octane story crafting doesn't really come out of nowhere. I know it's like a joke to make fun of the fact that Michael Bay is always an 11. And I think that's true. I mean, there are definitely arguments of times in where there is a reprieve. And some can argue it's kind of an abuse of the format.
Well, sometimes it doesn't work because of that. Like, some of his movies don't work because
sometimes
of that
people
problem.
Are like, Yeah, I'm too overwhelmed is sometimes people
and therefore
will say
don't
that.
Care. Like exactly. Some of those Transformer movies, that's what, exactly what happens.
I'd say that's usually a failure of writing, yeah. But this goes hand in hand with that. You know, it's like sometimes it's being used as a crutch. That's an example of bad screenwriting. But sometimes it's very effective. Like I would say almost the entirety of The Rock.
Yeah.
But there's this legitimate story trick that movies and TVs have done for hundreds of years or 100 years that have they coined it meanwhile back in the ranch. And I feel like we've talked about this a little bit. I definitely have talked to Adam about
it's
it.
All and, we talk about when we hang out.
The idea here is that you have like group A and you have like group B of characters with scenes from an A plot and a B plot. So you can cut to any scene and out of any scene just so, and this is what you want, it's only the relevant or exciting aspect of what's going on. So it's a good trick to have something to cut to so that in that one moment where that person says that one thing that really like, oh shit, it just got taken to the next level, you can cut away. And they call that meanwhile back at the ranch. This happened. Meanwhile, back where we started, this happened, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And audiences have gotten used to this over the years. And these movies are just that, but firing at a higher gear, mm-hmm. right? That's all that we're doing here. But the kind of assessment of what is being done and kind of the motivation for why they're doing it is the same. It's no different from Westerns from the 50s, right. You know?
Of course.
Another clear nod to Michael Bay, I noticed, is that when we kind of arrive at the tarmac, like after they land to get refuel, the inmates kind of have this moment where they realize, oh, the cops are coming. So we got to we have urgency suddenly. We're not in control of the situation. The cops are almost there because John Cusack's doing his thing. And that's when we get this counter movement sweeping dolly move, which you will all immediately recognize as like the Bad Boys shot, highway right. shot, right? It's in every Michael Bay movie ever. Someone turns to one side of the camera, the dolly moves from that spot all the way in, and it's at a slight angle, so we have this counter movement from, you know, let's say it's going right to left, but his face is going left to right. So we arrive at the perfect composition, and it's very fast. In fact, it's a very particular speed. Michael Bay always has the same speed. This shit happens literally in Con Air twice in a row. The first time at the airfield, there's a moment of when the cops arrive and bam, those shots just come out of the woodwork.
And that's out of the woodwork is a great description of where they come from.
You need a lot of camera track for these shots. They're big setups typically. They're
they
not
take a long time.
Shot.
Yeah,
and the reason you need more than you probably think is because they're not almost always they're not on a very wide lens. They're usually on a wide to medium, right. like probably a like a 40 yeah. to like 60 or something like that. And it means there's more space between the subject and the camera and the subject and the background. In other words, I think the plane set doesn't really have space for it.
Okay.
But the second they did have space outside. Oh boy, they went for it.
That's funny.
And I think that is a clear indication of them trying to ape the Michael Bay style. It's at least I'm probably, you know, Jerry Bruckheimer's probably, you know, spinning right now because like he kind of was a part of this whole
but
thing.
Michael Bay there's a great Every Frame a Painting about this. Like Michael Bay is very good at using many different elements to create counter motion, like not even just the actor, right? Like he'll use a dolly, then the actor, right. then a thing like a prop or like a plane in the background or whatever to like sort of finish the motion in a new direction. Like he's so good at that. And you can
he's layering it.
It's natural for him.
He's very aware of the
speed, he gets it. Like it seems to me like watching his work that he kind of he doesn't seem to take all day to get it either, so he really does kind of know how to choreograph like that.
I think he knows how specific he wants it and he knows how to build those shots, so he knows when to start them to not impact the schedule. You know, he gets more people.
Directors imitating Michael Bay never have quite the confidence or the flourish of his shots, Like
they don't.
There's the feeling of like, oh yeah, I know what this is. Like there's a familiarity to it. So it's sort of a comforting thing, but it never gives you the wow that Michael Bay does. He's great at that.
Yeah, I think that's from the Every Frame of Painting kind of, you don't see a lot of directors able to actually perfectly mimic it. And I would say that that extends to Simon West. He does a really good job.
Yeah.
But it kind of feels out of place a little bit just because it's less the execution of the actual shot, which is pretty good, and more the fact that it feels out of place in the film a little bit.
Right.
Like you haven't been seeing these crazy sweeping shots yet. And so it kind of comes out of nowhere. Maybe that I'm wrong about that and people are like, no, it's fine.
I don't think it bothers
you. But I think
that
there's something to be said. It doesn't bother you, but it's just like not what you're expecting necessarily based off the setup of the movie so far and what you've been watching.
It's been tight and controlled for the most part up to that point. It's not adventurous. Michael Bay movies always feel like the camera's just about to fall off the dolly or whatever. That's what's so cool about his movies is it's like, man, he really pushed that all the way, you know?
Right, yeah. I think that Edgar Wright does some good stuff.
He's more strategic.
He doesn't do the Michael Bay shot all the time. He has faked it in things like Hot Fuzz. But he also does the momentum kind of control with whip pans.
Yes.
That's his bread and butter, really. He loves whip pans that like land on a very, and fast editing, which is not unique to him. That's a very British sentiment to do the kind of jumpy cut thing that's been around forever. It's just people mimicking people. That's all. This is all it ever is. And I think that's probably the main reason that these movies all kind of look the same. We mentioned the bluish, colder color palettes. The telephoto coverage, the amped up pacing and editing. There's less of a focus on geography, unless it's like a set piece. And I think that they're all learning from each other and mimicking each other's work. So that's interesting. But also this, because this isn't Michael Bay, it may be a little rough around the edges if you're comparing it to like how Michael Bay this is. This is still a decent Michael Bay film.
Yeah,
Simon West, who isn't the names we mentioned before dominating the action genre in this era, still could piece this together effectively. And I think Jerry Bruckheimer knew what's up as well. And he knew that, like, look, I've worked on these movies with these directors. This is what they needed. That's what we're going to do. I'm going to give you the same stuff. You know, and that's a smart producer right there. There's a lot of questions about the, you know, validity of this movie. Is it a classic? Is it a bad movie? I don't know.
It's very silly.
I'm not going to wade in that shit. Yeah. But it's a type of movie that at one time was a very effective one. It's it's very anthemic of its time. And I still think there's a lot of nostalgia for that time to this day. And I think modern blockbusters and action movies still do these tricks. You mentioned like Christopher Nolan. I think critical darlings like him and Denis Villeneuve, they do pacing tricks that are not that different from what Michael Bay was doing in 1996 or 1997. And I think those recent films kind of came out of that tradition. It's not like they're faking or ripping off Michael Bay. It's just that tradition became kind of the zeitgeist. It took hold of this is how you make an action movie in the minds of a lot of directors and therefore in the minds of a lot of the audience members who watch these films for sure. And that's it. Those are my last thoughts on Con Air as being an example of a Michael Bay, non-Michael Bay
movie. Knockoff Michael Bay. They don't make this anymore.
They don't make a lot of movies anymore.
Right, obviously. Adam. You know, it's funny because you start, like, when you think about what is an action movie, you don't think of Marvel movies because that feels like they're their own genre, right? And they are. But like
they're like action adventure,
right? Every couple years a Die Hard ripoff comes out, and I guess this technically is a Die Hard, but like this for a long time felt very much like, you know, would be on a Mount Rushmore of like, you get it, summer action movies, right?
Yeah,
like there'd be some version of a Roland Emmerich film, some version of a Michael Bay film like Con Air, which isn't a Michael Bay film, you know, so, and then it's like one of those, a Die Hard.
Yeah.
You know, like that would be what it, and like Predator, something like Predator would be in there, you know?
Yeah.
Like that's action films. And I'm not sure if any of those films are really getting made consistently anymore. I mean, Moonfall is, right?
I think the palette is different. You get tired of the same thing. I think that there's a lot to be said about when nothing gold can stay, right?
I guess that's right. All things must pass.
All things must pass. People are going to get tired of it because they're going to see it for the sixth, seventh iteration. And they're going to be like, yeah, I got it when they did it this time. Or even if they're not aware that like what movie they saw that kind of thing in. They're kind of expecting it. You know, there's so many tropes in TV that are just so overly abused. The one I always mention is the someone disappears in act two of like a TV show, and then in act three comes back right at the time when your protagonist is about to be killed off by the villain and they got a gun at them and they're on the ground kind of thing. And then they get shot from behind the back by the character that hasn't been in the thing for a while,
which is your favorite times bit. You love it.
It's my favorite bit because what I love about that bit and how like the syntax of movies are like how that dialogue between the audience member and the filmmakers is happening regardless of if either side wants that conversation to be having. And it's funny to me that that trope in particular has lasted so long. Like it's present in the 70s, you know, in Bullet and shit. And it's also like abused in Game of Thrones, you know, like there it's wild how often it's used, and it's always been a crutch because it's like, oh yeah, it's so someone saved the day.
Yeah, it's a yada yada.
So it was all a fake out anyway. Like no one was really in danger because of the plot armor thing. But it's that type of stuff that we feel slighted when they do it too much. This is at a time when we didn't feel slighted by these maneuvers yet. Now I think we do.
Transformers
and like the CG fest of it all really sullied us on these types of movies because we were just like, oh man, if I'm getting this cool thing, I'm also getting this trash thing and I don't want the trash thing. And so those aren't expertly tied. You know, it's a very interesting soup that's going on here.
It's true. I mean, yeah, there's lots of genres that die out that you don't think of as being genres if they weren't something you cared about. Mm-hmm. And this like summer blockbuster Michael Bay movie is one of those where like, I bet you somebody who's like 20, you know, has absolutely couldn't care less about Con Air. Right. Like even if they watched it now, they'd be like, yeah, I don't care. Sort of like anybody that's like 5 to 10 years younger than me has no interest whatsoever in like, a knockoff French Connection.
Right.
Yeah, like even French Connection's like, you know, like Death Wish or The Enforcer.
That
whole genre is dead. We just don't make it anymore. You know?
We'll have a throwback in a movie, but it's not like going to start a new trend until it does, like the neo-western, you know, like sometimes it really does come back. But not necessarily always.
Not usually.
And the other thing about this kind of trend of filmmaking and all like kind of the details I described about like how they're approaching these movies, it is like we mention kind of a genre specific thing, but it's also pervasive to other genres. I want to look at like in 1997, I'm just looking at the list of like bigger movies.
Mm-hmm.
Fucking Volcano came out.
Volcano, baby.
Feels like a Roland Emmerich. It's definitely a Roland Emmerich.
Yeah.
But it's also a Michael Bay, right?
Right.
It's also got a lot of these shots, a lot of these techniques, which, you know, Roland Emmerich is also aping. So maybe it's just out of the aspect of the Roland Emmerichness of it all. But it's definitely something that there is some kind of two-way street happening between, you know, the disaster film and the action film, obviously.
That's a fun connection to make. Yeah, I mean, Roland Emmerich probably isn't as distinct a figure as I think he is, because people who were cinephiles probably have a sense of the disaster film directors that I don't connect to, that are like, well, he just stole it all from this guy, you know? Wonderful theory.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed myself listening to it. Also, I just kind of miss these movies a bit, so it's fun that
They're a lot of them. They're fun in a strange way.
It's so silly. Yeah, they're so silly.
So silly.
Right. They didn't feel silly at the time, too. That's the thing, is like, you know, the experience you had watching was like, yeah. And like, boy, you don't have that anymore. That's gone.
We're also children, more or less. So, you know,
I don't know. Like,
we could be distracted pretty easy.
I don't know if that's true, because, like, you know, my dad watches a dad movie from that time and has the same experience of it, it seems like. You know, like,
right.
I
might
maybe
be true then.
Maybe it's the movie watcher thing where if you don't watch, if you watch as many things as you and I do,
right,
the exhaustion
nothing
sets
works
in. I don't know.
And you're empty inside.
Right, exactly. Joy has gone from our hearts.
You just watch movies alone.
It
in
just
your room.
Happens to you.
Yeah.
The movie just happens to you.
The sound is on, but you're not hearing. Your eyes glaze over.
The film is lit, but you're not perceiving it.
Is the monitor reflecting my eyes, or is my eyes reflecting the monitor? Questions like this come up.
Has there ever been eye light for me? Have I ever had eye light?
And then you make a podcast. This is where we are. This is 2024. I've been Abe Epperson.
I've been Adam Ganser. For real, what a wonderful time. I really enjoyed
Thank
it.
Thank you, man.
I like it a lot.
Thank you. I love doing these with you. I love talking shop. They're exhausting, you know? These are exhausting days.
They're long days. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, nobody needs to hear us complain about it, but like,
a
director piece is, and this is similar to being a director.
It's the greatest job in the world.
It's a great job, and it requires intense analysis and concentration while you're doing it. Right? Like, that's a thing that I think when you haven't directed something, you think of directing in this kind of, you think of it as a much more passive experience than it really is. Like, the intense concentration that it takes to get a shot list and storyboards done, and then the intense concentration that it takes to get through a setup and a shot and get the thing and it works now. Like, the level of tension of all that. You get, like, we just get a micro dose of it creating director piece, and that's fun for us, you know?
Yeah.
But it is, but then you're tired. Right?
Well, yeah, and more for me, I like, there's so much shit that I'm like, oh, that could be a director piece, and
yes.
Then I watch it, and I'm like, that's
no,
garbage.
Can't.
I'm
yeah.
insulting
no,
everyone's time. This, at least, you know, people can go watch Con Air at home and listen to this episode and be like, that's true
that
about
was,
Con Air.
That was a thing. You're right.
That was a thing. I don't know if I care about that, but that's
but
true.
I have it
and
now.
And now I watch Con Air. That's you. That's you.
That's you. You sound like that. I watched Con Air a year and a half ago trying to find a director piece and did not retrieve one. So that's the joy of Abe and his unique brain, is he found this thing to talk about.
It's true. We both have brains that are different.
That's right. We're not the same person. Please stop telling us that we are.
Love it. That's true. You got to stop doing that, people.
Please stop.
Now they're just, what are we doing?
Now
they're just going to do it more.
We'll never end. This podcast will never be over.
Call us both Abe or Adam. Who gives a shit?
Yeah, nobody cares.
We're the
My parents call
guys.
Me Abe now, yeah.